So at the start of the service this morning, I conducted a little truth or false quiz to get us thinking about facts and our thoughts on certain facts. And as I mentioned earlier this month, on Palm Sunday, the BBC commissioned some research and released it on Palm Sunday about views of life after death and the resurrection. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to ask you openly to do thumbs up or arms folded about beliefs of the resurrection, life after death. Or maybe. No, I won't. Don't worry. But they found some very interesting things, and there's been a kind of bit of debate about the poll that they conducted, statistically verifiable and all that, but it came out with some interesting facts. And the first fact that got the headlines was this, which was that 25% of people who describe themselves as Christians do not believe in the resurrection. That was the kind of headline fact that came out there. However, 10% of people with no religion say that they do believe in the Easter story and the resurrection. Although the caveat was there was they weren't sure about the biblical account of it, that it shouldn't be taken literally. And similarly to that, 20% of non-religious people believe in life after death. So there's something strange going on there, that 25% of people who are Christians say they don't believe in the resurrection, but yet there's a kind of cultural belief that's still out there. But of those who did say that they believed in the resurrection, only 17% said that they believed the Bible version word for word. That was the question, that they believed the literal account that Jesus rose from the dead. And that rises to just over 50% of active Christians. So fortunately, if we take Brexit rules, resurrection means resurrection, because just over 50% of people agree with that. And finally, back in favour with democracy. For most people, for the rest of the people in that 50, just over half of Christians then, had some sort of doubt and questioning about the resurrection. Some felt that the story was true, but you couldn't take the literal account, that something was going on there, but we couldn't quite work out what it was. Some people, about 20%, affirmed that actually really did have to take the account as it was, a full, proper bodily resurrection. And a small percentage of people who don't have faith also said the same thing. And so when the story of Thomas came up today, that got me thinking. Got me thinking about Thomas and how Thomas might be a good example of faith for our time. One of the commenters about the piece on resurrection, Dr. Lorraine Kavanagh, who is from an organization called Modern Church, she tried to say that part of the problem here with the resurrection is, she says this, "I think people answering the survey are being asked to believe in a way that they might have been asked to believe when they were at Sunday school." Now, I think that's quite derogatory towards Sunday school. Being a children and youth worker, I think we're a little bit more robust in what we do than that implies. But she goes on to say, "You're talking about adults here, and an adult faith requires that it be constantly questioned and reinterpreted. So to ask an adult to believe in the resurrection in the way they did when they were at Sunday school, quote unquote, simply won't do. And that's true of much of the key elements of the Christian faith." Now, I suspect that myself and Dr. Kavanagh would disagree on how we do that and the answers that we might find. But nevertheless, I think her point happens to be true. I think we do need to think about our faith and to wrestle with those questions. I think it's true because belief and experience of faith is shaped by our culture around us. The values we hold to, the beliefs that are present in our culture, and quite often, the experiences we have of faith. And as that survey shows us, our society sends us some mixed messages about this, about our belief in the supernatural in particular. On the one hand, we would like to rationally dismiss the possibility of supernatural happenings. That's there in our philosophy and science. But on the other hand, we're continually drawn to explore and imagine all kinds of supernatural stories, from ghosts to superheroes to Sam Allardyce saving Crystal Palace's season. We're drawn into those accounts. There's something mysterious, something we're never quite sure of what's going on in our world. And so holding faith in what some people call a secular age means constantly having to address two questions. The first one is, why do I choose to believe? And the second one is, does my faith make sense? And those two questions are questions that we all have to think about and in some way answer. And here is where I think Thomas, as a disciple that we can admire and imitate. Now, it's unfortunate, perhaps, that Thomas is associated with the word doubt, doubting Thomas. But only because, as I said earlier, that's because we often consider doubt to be the opposite of faith. Being technical, you could say that unbelief is the opposite of belief. We don't have a word unfaith, but you kind of get my point. Doubt, in my view, isn't the opposite of faith. And that's because I don't see faith as being a case of simply believing in something. That if you doubt it, you can't let that in because it begins to gnaw away at that simple belief. Simply believing often leads to an attitude where you ignore inconsistencies, push them to one side, and at its worst can lead to trying to silence other views. La, 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 I'm not listening to you. And that can happen in religion, but it also happens in other areas of life, in politics, in science. Simply believing in something, digging our heels in and saying we won't change our minds, we're going to hold to it, whatever, gives some securities, but also creates some problems. Now, I think the faith of Thomas and the faith that Thomas displays is different from this. For him, his choice to believe is tied to the experience of seeking for himself what this is. He says, I won't believe unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side. Unless I do that, I will not believe. Now, having said that, Jesus, maybe remarkably, presents Thomas with that very opportunity. Jesus' response to this doubt is not to get cross or angry, but to say, here you are. And as far as we know, and I did some kind of scanning around this, Thomas is maybe the only disciple to actually touch Jesus post-resurrection. I tried to look for other things, maybe if Peter shook Jesus' hand after he took fish on the beach or something, I don't know. But actually, in terms of the story, Thomas examines the nail holes, puts his hand in the side. There's a lovely Caravaggio picture of Thomas doing this. It's a very intimate portrait. So maybe Thomas starts from doubt, but that doubt leads him into an intimacy, an understanding, an exploration that the other disciples don't seem to go into. And so rather than just simply believing, I like to think about this as believing simply. Taking on trust that God will reveal God's self when we have questions about God. Believing simply that asking our questions and exploring our doubts can lead us into greater understanding. Sometimes in response to our questions that we talk of each other, or that we offer to God in prayer. And sometimes in surprising ways, when we find and experience God's presence in our lives. Because it's experience that Thomas asks for and Thomas gets. But unlike Thomas, we can't physically see and touch Jesus. That proof, or better still, experience of the resurrection, isn't available to us. But that doesn't mean that we can't dig around the doubts that we have and find a renewed sense of faith. To help imagine this, I want to use another story that was in the newspapers this week. You may or may not have heard of it, but it's the story of a piano that was donated to a primary school, an old, battered-up piano that's worth approximately £300,000. It was given to a school by a couple in Shropshire who were downsizing their house, and so they took this piano, shipped it out, and took it to the school. And when they gave it to the school received it gladly, because that's what primary schools do to anything, but pianos in particular, something that you could definitely use and draw on. And when the music technician sat down to start playing the piano, he noticed that there were a few off notes, a few keys that were a bit sticky, that didn't quite depress as they ought to. I wonder whether he was beginning to have doubts as to whether they should have received this piano. Maybe if it had been me or you, we might have just thought, can you do an off note? We may have just thought, actually, this piano's no good. Let's just send this piano away. Let's just buy a new piano. Let's get an electric piano. But he didn't do that. There was something about this doubt, this experience of this not quite working, that made him think, okay, I'll take these keys off. I'll just see what the issue is here. And so he took one of the keys off, and underneath he found some corduroy, some white corduroy wrapping in thin strips. And he pulled one of those strips out, and he unfurled it, and inside were dozens of gold sovereigns. That's interesting. We had gold sovereigns in the piano. So then he took the lid off, took the outside off, and as he dug further and further into the piano, he found wrapping after wrapping after wrapping until he found an astonishing, let me see if I can find the numbers, 121 gold sovereigns. Most of them date from the Victorian period. Most of them have never been found on a hall in the UK. Some have been found elsewhere. Now, there's a rule that you have to do when you find things like this, which is to see whether it's yours, who's the owner. And that goes to the coroner's court. So the case of this piano went to the coroner's court. And remarkably, the couple who donated the piano couldn't prove the provenance, that they knew the gold sovereigns were there. Plus, it was no longer their property, because they'd given it away. So they put out an appeal for anybody who might have a genuine claim to this piano. The judge concluded that this was likely to be an early form of savings, security, hiding your wealth in a piano. And so they looked for relatives that they could trace from the ownership of this piano, and they couldn't find any. So the upshot of the story is that the gold sovereigns have been declared as treasure. And that means that they're owned by the crown, but any museum that will take that treasure is likely to give the face value to the finders. And that's going to be shared between the school and the people who donated the piano, with the majority of it going to the school. So what on earth has that got to do with the resurrection? In our second reading, Peter describes the resurrection as being like an inheritance, something that we have, a deposit, a guarantee of the hope that we have, particularly for life after death. And this is central to the faith we have in the resurrection. It's central to what the resurrection means in the Christian story. The gold coins and the piano were very likely to have been an intended inheritance for someone. But it was an inheritance that was never received. That inheritance ended up being claimed by someone who found it, and found them. We all are faced with the choice to believe. Faith can never be given to us. whether we're a child or whether we're an adult. And it's that choosing that makes the inheritance ours. But an inheritance only comes into play after we're gone. It does anchor our hope. But how can we dig around in understanding the resurrection now? Peter is very honest about the situation of faith for the Christians he's writing to. But he's not asking them to simply believe. The opposite. He's asking them to believe simply, to take the trust and hope that they have in the resurrection and to let it do some work in their lives as they go on searching, seeking, and receiving from God. And I find it very interesting that Peter tells them not just to simply believe, but also to think about the experience of faith as they have it. Though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy. Now, an inexpressible and glorious joy sounds like the kind of faith that's not really Anglican. We don't, maybe a little bit over the top. But what it's getting at here, I think, is that with the trials and struggles that we go through, we do have within these experiences of the power of the resurrection. And it's those experiences and digging around those experiences that is like finding those gold sovereigns for us. So maybe Thomas as a disciple is an example to us to think about our doubts in a way which gives us confidence to pull out the gold in those, to share together and to discuss together our struggles and our questions, to wrestle with whether our choice to believe and sense of faith is real, is valid. But it's also an encouragement to share together our inexplicable joys, the ways in which we have experienced God in our lives, the way in which faith has made sense to us in a time of doubt or difficulty. So my encouragement to us this morning is twofold. It's firstly to not see doubt as the enemy of faith, but to see doubt as a way into a deeper faith. It's not to simply believe and to just affirm that belief, but to believe simply and from that point, talk together and think together about the gold that might be hiding under those piano keys.